Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the festival's 2013 season, From Bach. This season, Music at Menlo celebrates Johann Sebastian Bach, the composer universally recognized as the greatest in Western music history. To the ears of many modern listeners, the canon begins with Bach. And in the 2.5 centuries since Bach's death, arguably every major musical innovation has borne his influence. Bach's legacy endures, whether in the craftsmanship of composers from Haydn to Mozart to Mendelssohn, in the sonic magnitude of Brahms, Bartok, and Shostakovich, and even in the sensual allure of Debussy, Richard Strauss, and George Gershwin. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts. The string quartet medium, arguably the spinal column of the chamber music literature, did not exist in Bach's lifetime. Yet even here, Bach's legacy is inescapable. The fugues of his seminal Well-Tempered Clavier, still among the most highly evolved works of their kind, inspired no less a genius than Mozart, who arranged a set of them for string quartet. The influence of Bach's fugal mastery permeates the contrapuntally ingenious Quintin Quartet by Joseph Haydn, considered the father of the string quartet, and even the piano quintet of Dmitri Shostakovich, composed nearly 200 years after Bach's death. And as the centerpiece of his Opus 132 quartet, Beethoven, after recovering from a serious illness, composed the Heiliger Dankesang, a convalescent's holy song of thanksgiving to the divinity. This transcendent movement recalls another Bachian signature, the Baroque master's sacred chorales. Concert Program 2, Quartet Dimensions, examines the ways in which Bach's music influenced the string quartet repertoire that would come into being after his death.
In the early 1780s, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was a frequent visitor to the home of the Baron Gottfried von Swieten, an imperial official at the Viennese court, as well as a great music lover and amateur composer. Von Swieten hosted Sunday salons, at which Mozart would play and study the fugues of Bach and Handel. By exploring these works, Mozart steadily developed his own facility at composing fugues, a musical form prevalent during the Baroque period, in which multiple voices enter in turn, playing the same musical idea, called a subject, creating a polyphonic conversation. Mozart wrote in a letter to his father at this time,
"The Baron von Swieten, to whom I go every Sunday, gave me all of the works of Handel and Sebastian Bach to take home with me after I had played them to him. When Constanze heard the fugues, she absolutely fell in love with them, and now she will listen to nothing but fugues, and particularly the works of Handel and Bach. Well, as she has often heard me play fugues out of my head, she asked if I had ever written any down. And when I said I had not, she scolded me roundly for not recording some of my compositions in this most artistic and beautiful of musical forms, and never ceased to entreat me until I wrote down a fugue for her."
In around 1782, there's some letters that he wrote saying how he wanted to get all of the works of Bach, and particularly the fugues of Bach, and also Bach's sons, and Handel.
Violinist Daniel Phillips.
He just got obsessed with the whole idea and wanted to take it as much as he possibly could. And at that point, he noticed kind of a spike in his attempts at writing fugues himself. So when he transcribed the fugues, that's a really good way to learn anyway. All composition students, especially in those days, knew that by copying out pieces and rearranging them, you learn sort of how they tick. So Mozart, like every musician since, holds Bach up to be the greatest composer who ever lived. And Bach was, of course, well known at being the master of the fugue. So Mozart, I guess, said, I want to do that. let me try.
Mozart's arrangements of 5 fugues from the Well-Tempered Clavier, Bach's seminal volume of preludes and fugues for keyboard, comprise one of several experiments with this form. Mozart's fascination with fugal writing, and with the fugues of Bach in particular, formed an integral part of the development of his craft.
He influenced a lot of composers in the future, obviously.
Danish quartet violinist Rune Tonsgaard Sørensen.
And with this whole fugue theme, he was, of course, the pioneer and the great master of that. So I think it's a very interesting theme to have for a festival and to see what other composers like discovered in this way of writing. So, of course, it's a very important part to do this music, and it's really, really beautiful music. And it's tricky because, you know, it's just fugues, and it's another way of playing, and all the usual elements in the music is some way different, I feel, when you're only playing fugues. So you have to work with it kind of differently, but it's a challenge, and you learn so much from playing these Bach pieces.
I think what's special about when Bach did his fugues, you had the feeling that you start something and then everything falls into place.
Danish quartet violist Asbjørn Norgaard and cellist Frederik Sjolin.
You start playing and then you know the timing and it just kind of almost plays itself if you have the right feeling from the beginning. And not so many composers achieve this thing afterwards. It's always a bit more struggle, like it doesn't come so natural somehow.
It's almost like he wrote them backwards or something because they're so well, you know, they always end up in the perfect way.
The program continues with Joseph Haydn's String Quartet in D minor, Opus 76, No. 2, nicknamed the Quinton Quartet.
Haydn's life and career embodied the breadth of music's classical period. When he was born in 1732, the Baroque period had reached its apogee. And over the course of Haydn's life, indeed largely by his own hand, what has since become known as the classical style would grow to maturity. By the time of Haydn's death in 1809, his own student, Ludwig van Beethoven, was boldly extending the classical idiom with his own brand of fiery individualism. And within 5 years, the precocious Viennese teenager, Franz Schubert, would pen his first significant works. In addition to being recognized as the father of the classical style, Haydn is also specifically and rightfully regarded as the father of the modern string quartet. He composed some 68 quartets over his career, developing the medium along the way into the centerpiece of the chamber music literature, which it remains today. The string quartet genre in its earliest form, and this can be said of Haydn's earliest quartets as well, essentially evolved a virtuosic first violin part and a supporting cast of second violin, viola, and cello. But through Haydn's innovations, the genre evolved into a sophisticated dialogue between 4 voices, each with a distinct identity. The Quinton Quartet, composed in 1797, represents Haydn's fully matured quartet writing style. At the same time, its counterpoint harkens back to the music of the Baroque period. As with the Bach fugue, the quartet integrates unassailable design with expressive power. The preeminent Haydn scholar, H.C. Robbins Landon, described this work as, quote, one of the most serious, learned, and intellectually formidable works he ever wrote, end quote. The quartet's nickname, Quinton, meaning fifths, comes from the first movement's opening theme, which begins with 2 descending melodic gestures, each spanning the interval of a fifth. This motif serves as a point of departure for Haydn's characteristically eloquent first theme. Now, that four-note motif doesn't just launch the first theme. It serves as the basis of the entire exposition. And this is worth a quick nutshell explanation of classical sonata form. In a sonata form movement, which is what the first movement is in pretty much every multi-movement work of Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and composers throughout the 19th century too, you have three parts: the exposition, the development, and the recapitulation. In the exposition, the composer introduces the piece's central melody, the first theme, followed by the second theme, which is typically of a contrasting character in a different key. And then in the development section, material from the exposition is somehow transformed. The themes are fragmented, transposed to more different keys, whatever devices the composer might come up with to develop the theme. And finally, in the recapitulation, the first and second themes from the exposition come back, in full, and now both in the home key. So, back to the Quintin Quartet. What Haydn does here is he takes that opening four-note motif, let's call it the Quintin motif, and builds the whole exposition from it. After introducing the first theme, he spins a series of melodic ideas, all closely related to the Quintin motif. And, strictly speaking, he never really gives us a second theme. Rather, everything is an outgrowth of the first theme, tied together by the Quintin motif. What comes right after the first theme, for example, might initially sound like, aha, here's the second theme. It's a new melody, the music's gone from D minor to F major. But if you listen carefully, underneath that, you'll hear the Quintin motif. First in the viola, then passed off to the second violin, then to the cello. Here's another passage, just a few measures later in the exposition. Again, listen carefully and see if you can hear, amidst all the sophisticated counterpoint, how the Quintin motif permeates everything that's going on. In the development section, Haydn continues obsessively working over the Quintin motif. J.S. Bach's obituary describes the composer's indefatigable inventiveness in counterpoint and fugue, claiming that, quote, he had only to hear any main theme to have in mind, as if instantaneously, almost everything artful that could be done with it, end quote. In the Quintin Quartet, Haydn seems to be channeling that aspect of Bach's artistry, exhaustively seeking everything artful that can be done with his four-note motif.
And it just has so much energy all the time. It's always going somewhere.
Danish quartet violist Asbjørn Nørgaard.
Like, sometimes when you play Haydn, you feel like you have to be really elegant and very sweet and singing. But in this quartet, you can actually be pretty rough. You can play like a farmer almost. Like, it feels like you're on a farm in Austria and people are dancing, you know?
Just to follow up this farm thing, the third movement, the minuet, is not like what you think of a normal minuet from that time.
Danish quartet violinist Frederik Åland.
It's like a really like a peasant dance. And it just goes, the two violins plays together and the cello and the viola plays together, the same line, almost as a fugue actually, or as a little canon. This works out really, really well, and it's really a lot of fun to play it. This last movement, which is more like a lot of spirit, a lot of like fast-paced movement, is really a great piece, and we enjoy extremely to play this.
I think the nice thing about the Quint Quartet is that it's so youthful.
Asbjørn Nørgaard.
It has so much energy. It was one of the first Haydn quartets we did when we were younger. It fitted us very well when we were like 20 years old, young guys with a lot of energy, and has this very... It's always moving, it's always going somewhere. It's one of the more masculine Haydn quartets.
The Russian pianist and composer Dmitri Shostakovich produced some of the 20th century's most fiercely expressive music. His body of work is even more compelling when considered in the context of the difficult circumstances surrounding his life and career. Shostakovich's name has become virtually synonymous with the intensity of his musical reaction to Stalinism. His work serves as a kind of musical chronicle of the harsh social conditions that followed the 1917 October Revolution and life under Stalin's regime. Shostakovich's response to his socio-political climate is manifested in his oeuvre of 15 symphonies, 15 string quartets, and myriad other works, which collectively represent one of the 20th century's most significant artistic achievements. Shostakovich composed his Opus 57 piano quintet in 1940 at the request of the Beethoven String Quartet, one of Russia's preeminent chamber ensembles. The Beethoven Quartet had recently performed Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 1 and was eager for more music from the 34-year-old composer, particularly a piano quintet, which would allow them to perform with Shostakovich. This marked the beginning of a long and significant artistic relationship. The Beethoven Quartet would premiere the next 13 of Shostakovich's string quartets. Shostakovich dedicated his 3rd and 5th quartets to the Beethoven Quartet, and his 11th through 14th to its individual members. The piano quintet isn't a work that directly or even implicitly deals with the socio-political climate of the day, except insofar as Shostakovich's language in general might be heard as influenced by his circumstances. Indeed, despite no political program, the quintet shares the range of expressive power that characterizes such works as his 8th string quartet, famously dedicated to victims of fascism and war. In fact, when the quintet was premiered, one Russian newspaper praised it as, quote, a portrait of our age, the rich-toned, perfect voice of the present, end quote. The following year, the quintet received the inaugural Stalin Prize, a newly established state prize recognizing excellence in the arts and sciences. The prize included a considerable cash award of 100,000 rubles, which Shostakovich contributed to charity for Moscow's poor. The quintet begins with a nod to a Baroque convention associated with Johann Sebastian Bach. Its first two movements are a prelude and fugue.
With Shostakovich, there's so many layers to this music, of course.
Danish quartet violinist Rune Tonsgaard Sørensen.
It's a very interesting piece. Beautiful and with a lot of different contrast, very, very clear characters. The first one is like very, very, very strong, very dramatic. It opens up with this big G minor piano chord. And it's like a prelude, almost like an opening overture of this whole piece. Then there's this beautiful fugue, very, very, very slow, E-flat minor fugue, which is kind of the center, the heavy part of this piece, one of the most, you know, intimate and beautiful movements that I know.
After the emotionally devastating fugue, Shostakovich offers the listener some measure of relief with the rambunctious scherzo. The quintet follows an unusual five-movement plan. In between the scherzo and finale comes a slow, plaintive intermezzo. The intermezzo proceeds without pause to the gently optimistic final movement.
And the last one is actually a huge contrast to the four previous movements.
Rune Tonsgaard Sørensen.
It's in major, it's much more bright, much more, it seems like he's relieved, you know, you go through this whole crazy story in the first four movements, and then in the last movement, you feel like, okay, this is where we want to be, and it ends really beautiful in G major, like just flying away somehow. It's a great piece.
Near the end of his life, after completing his last symphony and his last piano sonata, Ludwig van Beethoven turned once again to the string quartet as the medium for his deepest musical thoughts, after a 12-year hiatus. The quartets to which Beethoven devoted his final years represent the pinnacle of the composer's mighty creative powers and infinite imagination. In the five late quartets, opuses 127, 130, 131, 132, and 135, Beethoven surpassed all precedent for the expressive capabilities of music, as if transcending this world and composing for listeners of future generations. Beethoven began the string quartet in A minor, opus 132, in the winter of 1824 and completed it the following July. The quartet is in five movements, though studies of Beethoven's sketchbooks suggest that he originally planned a more traditional four-movement structure. But his work on the quartet was interrupted for 1 month by a severe intestinal illness, and upon recovery, Beethoven added the quartet's substantial third movement, a convalescence holy song of thanksgiving to the deity in the Lydian mode, which would come to be regarded as the heart of the work. The Schuppanzigh Quartet gave opus 132 its unofficial premiere on September 9, 1825, at a Viennese tavern for an audience of 14. The public premiere took place 2 months later.
The first movement starts in very late Beethoven style.
Danish quartet violist Asbjørn Norgaard.
Starts very slowly and it has this kind of intervals that he always uses, small seconds everywhere, and it kind of creeps out from the deep cello. After a while, the first violin burst into a line, and then you get the first movement, where the material all the way through is actually the material of the first four bars. Beethoven is so masterful at getting a lot out of not so much material. And to listen to this quartet, you need to see the big shape of it.
The first movement has a free-spirited quality. Though essentially following sonata form, the emergence of each new musical idea has more the feeling of the next logical thought than something formulaically conceived for the sake of thematic contrast. Following these opening measures, a brief melodic phrase, marked by three repeated notes, comes to the surface and passes through all four instruments. This blossoms effortlessly into a flowing theme in the second violin. Beethoven proceeds in this fashion throughout the movement, expanding on the basic material presented at the outset of the work, and exploiting it to craft a very rich movement indeed, whose psychological and emotional complexity can't be simply or decisively articulated.
So the first movement is not a very big, long first movement. It's somehow still building up. It ends pretty soon, and it didn't peak completely somehow. The second movement has this, it's a lighter in the character, it's not so deep, so serious, it's just kind of beautiful. It has a singing beautiful line that goes around. And then this is the way Beethoven sets up for the third movement, which is the longest movement of the quartet. It's almost 20 minutes long. You can really feel it's the most important movement in the quartet for him. He wrote it after recovering from a disease. He was very sick, and then he recovered, and then he wrote this movement in the praise of the Lord, to thank the Lord for making him healthy again.
Beethoven inscribed above the third movement of the quartet, Heiliger Dankesang eines Genesenen an die Gottheit in der Liedischen Tonart. Holy song of thanksgiving to the divinity by a convalescent in the Lydian mode. The movement begins with a solemn chorale melody.
It has these two sides. It has the choral. Time is stopped. He's not on Earth anymore. He's like flying around. There's no phrasing, no movement. It's just like a very beautiful chorale, sustained. And then the second part is that rejoicement of life. Very bright major scales running around. Very lively.
Beethoven marks the following section: Neue Kraft fühlend. Feeling of new strength.
And then he goes back and forth between these two parts. And in the end, the chorale means something else. Like, in the end, you heard the chorale a couple of times. When you've played it, you feel like it gets deeper and deeper, and you get somehow closer and closer to God.
The Heiliger Dankesang alternates between varied restatements of the Bach-like chorale and the Neue Kraft music. The movement ends with a final utterance of the Heiliger Dankesang, which Beethoven marks to be played with the most intimate emotions.
And you feel like when you play this third movement, you literally feel like you're closer to God. Even if you're not religious, you actually feel it. And I think Beethoven really achieved something with this movement. And he set it up with the first two movements as well.
Following the great spiritual magnitude of the Heiliger Dankesang, Beethoven gives the listener a welcome respite with a good-humored march movement. Understandable, perhaps, as an extension of the previous movement's celebration of newfound vigor. But lest the listener hear this brief march simply as a kind of palate cleanser after the Heiliger Dankesang, Beethoven rounds it off in striking fashion. Above dramatic tremolando in the lower strings, the first violin issues a declamatory recitative. The recitative proceeds attacca, or without pause, to the sonata rondo finale, marked allegro appassionato.
And then a very, like, triumphant last movement, which doesn't take focus from the third movement. So he built the whole quartet very well, so everything points to the third movement. None of the other movements really take focus from it, but you still need them. You can't just play the third movement alone. You need the build-up, and you need the to relax a bit afterwards and have a final somehow.
In 2005, Music at Menlo's Beethoven season, Audio Notes featured extensive discussion of all the Beethoven string quartets, including Opus 132, more extensive than we're able to fit on this season's installment. Artistic director David Finkel, himself, of course, very intimately familiar with these works, walks through the quartet with detailed musical examples. If you would like to listen to David's analysis of Beethoven's Opus 132, it's available on our website, at www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audio notes. Audio Notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional narration is provided by Andrew Goldstein. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. J.S. Bach's Concerto in C Major for Two Pianos is performed by João Carlos Martins, José Eduardo Martins, and the Sofia Soloist Chamber Orchestra, and appears courtesy of Labor Records. Franz Schubert's Rondo in A Major for Piano Four Hands, performed by Paul Lewis and Stephen Osborne, and Dmitri Shostakovich's Piano Quintet, performed by the St. Petersburg Quartet and Igor Uryash, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Robert Schumann's Andante and Variations for Two Pianos, Two Cellos, and Horn, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazi, Vovka Ashkenazi, Radovan Vladkovich, Georg Donderer, and Matthias Donderer. Bela Bartok's Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion, performed by Martha Argerich, Nelson Friere, Peter Sadlo, and Edgar Gugeas. And Joseph Haydn's Quinten Quartet and Ludwig van Beethoven's Opus 132 Quartet, performed by the Emerson String Quartet, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Bach's Fantasy and Fugue in A Minor, performed by Claude Frank. Mozart's string quartet arrangements of fugues from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, performed by the Orion String Quartet. And Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8, performed by the Miro Quartet, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.